We tell stories to share the human experience.
No matter what form it takes.
Actor, photographer, theatre maker, musician, whoever is trying to be heard.
We can't stop telling stories. There's no end to them.
By telling stories, we connect to each other and create a sense of community.
This is an opportunity to share stories from a talented and diverse range of individuals, in the hope it provides inspiration and knowledge.
This is a podcast about Australian storytelling in all its forms, hosted by two Australians in the arts industry.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Lauren Bailey.
And I'm Nick Kane.
And thanks for listening.
Podcast 15 is upon us. That's our crystal anniversary, Lauren Bailey. Congratulations.
Wow, does that mean, what does that mean? You're buying me something?
I don't know, just crystal? Something crystal? That, I don't okay. know. I don't know. It's just, that is what it is. 15 years usually, but we'll take it for 15 podcasts in this regard.
Okay. What are you telling me?
So I was doing a bit of research on the number 15, just because, you know.
Wow, too much time on your hands.
Maybe too much time on your hands. As you'll find out later, that's not the case.
Not so.
Oh, Lauren, can we start talking about something related to the act of storytelling now? What do you think?
I hope so.
You've had a really interesting month, Lauren, so I did want to ask you, how did you end up going in Bali?
Oh, goodness. You know, it's hard when you do a lot of work and you learn a lot of things to really try to contextualize that and just drill it down to one or two things that you got out of the work.
I know, but I think it is useful, isn't it? Because I always sit down at the start of every podcast before we go live and think about how I can contextualize my month. But that is one of the hardest things, isn't it? But I think it's important to ensure that you can get it down to one or two takeouts so that you can actually digest it a little bit easier.
And I said a little bit to you before we started recording today, this is the third year I've trained with Ale. And the previous 2 years, I've found out a lot about myself as a performer and what I'm capable of. But this year, I really understood how I can rely on myself both as a performer and as a person. And wow. Coming back to Melbourne this year, rather than just going, oh, what did I learn as an actor and how do I bring that back into my work? I kind of want the work that I do in my life and my career from this point forward to come from the place that I found in Bali. I didn't have any Wi-Fi access, which was a little stressful for a while, but then I just let that go. So I really just shut off and tuned into the work and the processes that I go through as a performer, what challenges me personally and through my work. And yeah, I don't know, it's sounding all very serious, but it's actually really exciting. And I just feel like I've come back to Melbourne in a really strong place, and I'm really excited about what comes next. And in a way, if you look at it, I went to Bali last year, the day after I finished my full-time work. And it was very much the mountain climb and all the training was very much about how am I going to face life going forward? How am I going to meet challenges? And so a year later, it's more about, well, I've kind of proved to myself how I'm going to work and my level of commitment, so I can settle into that.
And so when you say from a place that you are in, when you talk about your work, you want to come back and work from a place that you were in Bali, is that a, talk to me about that a bit more. Is that an inner flame? Is that a purpose? Is that an intent?
I think when we go into work as any type of artist, I assume, but certainly for me as an actor, there's an element of, can I trust that what I know is in me will come to the fore? Yeah. Can I trust that I've done the work?
Mm-hmm.
And if I haven't had time, if you've had an audition at last minute and I haven't had time to do all the work that I might normally do, can I trust that my years of experience and learning and my innate talent will all come together and I'll be able to do what I need to do in the moment?
Yeah.
One way or another through the training, you know, we did 15 to 18 hours of work a day. So it was pretty intensive. And on the journey of that training, I ultimately discovered that, yes, I can trust that all of those things are there. And because I'm someone that likes to work really hard to make things happen, I also discovered that my commitment is enough for those things to be there. that actually the more I struggle to try to make sure things are there and that things happen, the harder it is for those things to just be there. It's enough for me to trust that I'm committed and that the work will be done.
Trust. So it's coming from a place of trust in yourself, which is beautiful.
Yeah, I could have just said that, couldn't I?
No, but I think, no, I don't know. That's a really beautiful thing. And hopefully the next 6 to 8 months, 12 months, really start to play that out into your life back here.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I mean about rather than bringing it into my work, it's coming from that place in my work
as well.
That what I need is there and working from that point. You know, and I've had a few auditions also this month and things are really coming together. I'm very excited about life. So.
Yeah. I hope you don't mind me saying, Lauren, is when I spoke to you, you were on your way home and we spoke via Skype very quickly. I just remember speaking to you then and seeing in your eyes and in your manner how comfortable you were at that point and how satisfied and assured you were as a person. And I guess, you know, when you get to do that much work over a period of time like you were saying 15 to 18 hours is a lot of work per day. It's amazing how that can just radiate through you as a person as well and really hold you in good stead as, you know, a confident human being. So you're coming back to Melbourne in a really great headspace.
Well, isn't that the thing in our lives here? It really is a privilege to be able to work for that amount of time on something.
Oh, it sounds like you've had a great month, Lauren.
So it has been a pretty exciting month. And it was interesting being completely shut off from everything that was happening here. And of course, I was completely switched off from what was happening for you. And when we did reconnect, you didn't seem like you had too much time on your hands at all. You seemed like you'd been very busy. Can we talk about that?
Totally. Yeah, no, that's a beautiful lead-in because I actually remember that chat and I was looking at your little Skype screen and how confident and assured and happy you were. And then I glanced at my little screen and just saw myself and how stressed and how, how vulnerable I felt. And I'd actually lost a fair bit of weight this month, would you believe, through stress. I think that's the easiest way to put it. And it's funny. Like, Lauren, do you have techniques that you use to deal with stress?
I guess one of my main techniques is that I meditate. And I've been doing that for 2 or 3 years now. So that's a huge way for me to deal with stress.
Yeah, I like to meditate as well. And I've got different techniques that I utilise, you know, whether it be vocal techniques or stretching or whatever it might be. I like to listen to my body. I found this month, though, I got to a stage where I noticed myself shallow breathing quite a lot. And so my breaths just weren't going down into my diaphragm. And no matter how much I tried, I couldn't get it to go down. And it probably put more stress on me because I was like, what's going on with my body that I can't regulate this? And I just want to read a quick snapshot from a book. Someone posted this on their wall, a friend of mine, and I just thought it was an interesting little tidbit from a book called Freeing Shakespeare's Voice, The Actor's Guide to Talking the Text. It's by Christian Linklater. This is just a little paragraph that I'm going to read out, and I think this kind of sums up how I was feeling. And at the time, this was a very freeing thought. So if you're out there and you're having a similar struggle to me, this might help you in some way, just to have a little think about this. Today's adult voice is deprived of the nourishment of emotion and free breathing. Society has taught us that it is wrong to express ourselves freely. Conventional child raising tells children that it is not nice to shout, that it is ugly and dangerous to get angry, and that it is upsetting to others to cry in public, and that loud hoots of laughter are disturbing. The adult voice is the product of other people's voices, saying, "That's bad, it's weak to cry, you'll frighten men away with that big voice, or never use that tone of voice to me." All too often, and this is where I really started to go, ooh. All too often, the breathing musculature has been dislocated from its instinctual connections by physical blows as well as psychological ones. The adult voice is, in most instances, conditioned to talk about feelings rather than to reveal them. The breath that fuels this descriptive mechanism comes from the top portion of the lungs. The throat, tongue, and jaw muscles deflect the impulse to communicate from the danger zone of the diaphragm to more manageable areas. I just think that's an interesting thought to put out there, and it's certainly one that stuck with me. I felt like a lot of my stress was coming from a inability to communicate when I had too much work on my plate, and also how to then
alleviate
the work pressure. That's exactly right. So it was interesting reading that. I went, oh, it's a good point, because I did. I started to feel, you know, as you do, your jaw tightening. I wasn't breathing into my diaphragm, and it was because it was holding this emotional cargo, if you will. And having read that, it's quite funny how mentally you can then go, I get it. Not to say it was just a matter of I get it and then I started breathing more regularly, but what it did was allow me to have a way forward to be able to open up my diaphragm.
And isn't that interesting when you think about what we concentrate on, or what we're aware of is the thing that perpetuates. So yes. You became aware that you were shallow breathing, but try as you might, you couldn't, even your hands just then were like, get the breathing to go down.
Yeah.
But when you become aware of why you're reacting that way, and it opens up your ideas about what's possible, then you have a different image of breathing normally, and slowly your awareness and reality shift to that new focus.
Exactly. And I think that's the beauty sometimes of having a teacher or seeking out information, is that it can make you look at things in a different way that will then help you. So I don't know, that was just a big moment, and I'm still working through it at the moment. I actually went to a fantastic meditation class yesterday. It was 2 hours, Lauren, and it was in a beautiful little spot. This is where I give just a shameless plug to Des Dalton from Life, Body, Mind. And it was great to just spend 2 hours, as you said before, Lauren, having the privilege of spending 2 hours concentrating on meditation and calming your muscles and your body and your mind. That was a big thing for me, and I really love that takeout. I've kind of changed my takeout now, Lauren, because of the way that you just so eloquently put it. I really love the point that you mentioned about
what we focus on is what we perpetuate.
Totally. Because I think learning why and then having the information to alter what you're doing to then allow you the freedom. And I am proud of myself for that too, because I think sometimes we don't give ourselves enough kudos for trying to find those solutions and then working through them. But I have had a month of action as well, and probably a little bit of the stress has brought that on, but I've also had a lot of auditions, getting to know a lot of the casting agents in Sydney as well, which has been lovely. And it's one of the things I noticed was being in different audition rooms. I know this sounds strange, right? But when you get used to certain audition rooms, and suddenly when you're in these new spaces, it's a whole different ball game, and you've got to use all your techniques to make sure that you can concentrate and deliver what you need to.
Yeah.
Just an interesting little insight, but it is an exciting time.
So maybe that's a great time to get stuck into this month's interview then, which is.
This is an exciting one, Lauren. This is big.
Explodes my mind a little bit, if that's possible. So on that note, let's get stuck into it.
We are here today with Iranian-Australian filmmaker Nora Niasari. Welcome, Nora.
Hello.
Hi. Nora and I are, of course, in her study, hanging out. And you're in your study in Sydney.
Well, I'm in Sydney, of course. You guys are down in Melbourne. Nora, can you tell us why today we're in your study? Is it a place where you have a lot of creativity spawning from?
Yeah, I mean, this study, it's where I do all my editing and writing and reading as well. So I thought it would be a good place to meet you today.
And so to get started, we'll get you to read your story for us.
No worries. I wasn't one of those kids who made Super 8 family movies and knew I wanted to be a filmmaker from the age of 10 after watching The Lion King. At that time, I wanted to be a lawyer because I was good at arguing for things that were important to me. Following my parents' divorce, my dad moved back to Iran and we moved around a lot, living in government housing in the suburbs of Brisbane. We lived in a very low socioeconomic area. My neighbour was a drug dealer and my best friend's sister was pregnant at 15. It was the 90s and we were the only migrant family there. Thankfully, my mum did take us to the Brisbane Film Festival where I saw Abbas Kiarostami's films for the first time. My mum worked and studied hard for us to leave that part of Brisbane, and we moved to Sydney where she studied her master's. At high school in Sydney, I became very close with other Iranian kids and started Persian Saturday School. I felt like we were becoming a part of a community there. But as usual, we couldn't stay in one place due to my mum's work, and I changed schools 3 times. I went to some challenging public schools. It was good in a way because I developed a thick skin as the new girl and came across many different types of people from diverse backgrounds. The one constant thread was visual art in English class, where I had a few great teachers who encouraged me a lot. I was always very involved and passionate about what I was reading and creating. Even though I received the highest score in art, my mum wasn't so happy about me going to art school, so I decided to study architecture. I enjoyed studying architecture, but I always got stuck in the material constraints because my buildings were always trying to tell stories and the renders were too cinematic, as my tutor once said. In my final year of architecture, I was accepted into a travelling film workshop in Cardiff, funded by the British Council. It was led by one of my first mentors, artist-architect Richard Goodwin, and it was my first trip overseas. In this workshop, we had 1 week to find subjects that addressed an urban issue in the city. I teamed up with 2 documentary film students, and we made a short film about a multicultural and marginalised community in Cardiff called Bute Town. We met some unique migrant residents who led us into their homes and told us their stories. Unfortunately, they'd been segregated following the decline of the coal exchange and the construction of surrounding gated communities. When I returned to Australia, I decided to change my path and continue making documentary and narrative films. The transition from architecture to film took me a few years, but I'm thankful to be telling stories in this beautiful medium.
Yay.
Beautiful. And I guess we're going to have a great in-depth conversation today, Nora, but I did want to start with something close to my heart. You seem to be mentioning The Lion King nice and early there, and sounds like you might not have been necessarily the biggest fan.
No, I was definitely a fan, but it wasn't, you know. I mean, at that time, you know, there was The Lion King, there was like Indiana Jones, Pocahontas.
So you're telling me you didn't cry when Simba's father died?
I totally cried.
We can continue with the interview then.
You know, we have mentioned The Lion King a couple of times on this podcast, would you believe it or not?
Nick has actually sung for us on the other occasion.
I have. I'm planning on singing a duet with Lulu, who was one of our guests, at some point for a podcast into the future. I'm sure of it.
It looks like Lion King is a formative film for everybody.
Indeed it is.
So talking about formative years, you were born in Tehran, the capital of Iran.
Yes.
And did you spend a few years there, or what point did you move to Australia?
We moved to Australia when I was 1, so when I was still a baby, for my dad's studies in Australia, because he was pursuing his PhD at the University of Queensland.
Right.
And so that was the main reason why we came here.
And what was that in, if you don't mind me asking? What was the PhD in? Was he in a creative space with it?
No, it's in veterinary science. He's a vet.
Oh, fantastic.
Wow. He's a professor in that field. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you grew up in a very low socioeconomic area in government housing in Brisbane. Despite those conditions, would you say you had a happy childhood?
I mean, the thing is that at the time, I didn't feel like we were in a lesser situation than anybody else, because I had a very happy childhood, you know. I mean, my mum, you know, she did a great job in creating a very loving environment, and, you know, I had a lot of friends at school who, you know, I mean, when up until the age of 10, you're just enjoying, you know, wide open spaces, playing sport, you know, you don't really have that many worries. But I think it was more difficult for my mom than for me.
Your mum has clearly been a great influence on you and support throughout your life. You mentioned that when you moved to Sydney, that was so that she could study her master's. What field was that in?
So she studied her master's in audiology, which is a hearing specialist.
Ah. Yeah.
So very practical professions, really, at the end of the day, with your parents, with a vet and an audiologist. Did they have any creative pursuits as well that they'd follow?
My dad, no. He was very much into veterinary science. But my mum was very into literature, and she studied psychology and philosophy as well. But obviously it wasn't a very practical field to pursue seeing as a single mother with two kids.
Yeah. Mm. And so when you moved from Brisbane to Sydney, did you notice, were you aware of the artistic and cultural differences between the two states at that time?
I'm sure that there was a lot of artistic activity in Brisbane, just not where I was living. And in Sydney, we also weren't living in the heart of art and culture. But, I mean, I think it was more important for me, the move to Sydney, because I felt like I became a part of a community there and I made a lot of friends who I felt I had a common ground with.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned that because you had to move around a lot, you developed a thick skin as the new girl. Mm. Do you think that moving around, the exposure to different places, do you feel like that's aided you later on in your career?
I think moving around did help me to become more curious about my surroundings and people in my surroundings. So I think that it did, you know, affect the way that I see the world today. But at the same time, I think that stability is important to a child's upbringing. But I think that, you know, both sides of the coin are good and bad. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's move forward a little bit to when you went to uni and you studied architecture. It's funny, we were speaking to actress Anne Truong. Well, she's many things, but actress is one that comes to mind.
Yeah.
Anne Truong, and she studied psychology before she then made the bridge to acting.
Yeah.
So it was just interesting. Do you feel the same way, that it was sort of a natural progression and that you use your architectural skills as you flow into filmmaking and art?
I mean, for me, it really did feel like a smooth transition. Mostly because I was sort of sub-majoring in film. I mean, I was taking some film theory classes and I did a few workshops.
So it was very much, the passion was there. It was bubbling away as you were doing the architecture degree.
Yeah, it was definitely, the passion was there. And with architecture, you know, when you're designing a project, you have this research base for that project, and a lot of that research is quite similar to the research that you do before you write a film, in a sense that you study the context, you study the society of that place, you're looking at, you know, different types of layers of that place and how you can design accordingly. And I think similarly when you write a film or tell a story, you're looking for those layers that can contribute to the narrative as well. So I think at an initial stage, they're very similar
and
processes.
You're right, a lot of that insight as well, like a lot of major buildings that are made now, the insight that goes into how it'll be used, the community that it surrounds. There's actually a lot of films being made in the pitch process for large buildings as well that tell that story in a much more human element than we think when we think bricks and mortar architecture.
Yeah, absolutely, because I think that, you know, ultimately architecture should be telling a story about us, and because we're living in it every day. So there is a lot of similarities, especially in... also in image creation, like when you're presenting a project, you have to really bring it to life without it being built. So, you know, in a similar way as when you pitch a film, you have to tell that story as well. So, yeah.
So you completed your architecture degree at the University of Technology in Sydney.
Yeah.
Including the film workshop in Cardiff in your last year. And then you decided to change your path and continue making documentary and narrative films. Was the film workshop in Beirut next step? Do you want to jump in there? I was going to ask.
Yeah. So basically a few months after I completed the Cardiff workshop, there was another elective in the architecture school that was run by a Lebanese professor. And this workshop was set in Beirut, and it was about reconstruction after the Lebanese Civil War. Mm-hmm. And so all of my classmates were designing buildings, and I proposed to my professor Adrian if I could make a short film as a sort of,
great,
you know, as a sort of exercise.
Yeah.
And he was really happy to accept that because he was my mentor, and he was really encouraging the filmmaking side of my interests.
Yeah. And that film, that's Vehicles of Memory.
Yes.
I mean, that is quite amazing.
Yeah.
We've had a little Nora Niasari movie marathon over the last few days.
We have.
Oh, you're too good.
It's been pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And of course, it was filmed as you sat in the back of the cab in Beirut using a local lesson interpreter and asking the cab drivers about the formal division of Beirut known as the Green Line that used to be as they drove through the part of the city that was formerly the front line of the Lebanese Civil War from 1975 to 1990. And again, there's this idea, you know, you said my buildings were always trying to tell stories.
Yeah.
Your film perspective at this point seems very much inspired by the impact on humanity of buildings, but also the societal confines that we choose to surround ourselves with. Is that sort of what were you feeling like you wanted to express through your storytelling at that time?
Yeah. I mean, for me, what really interested me was the changes in a city and how those changes affected human beings and their relationship to their past. Mm-hmm. And in places like Beirut, it's so pregnant with this notion of, you know, reconstructing an identity and how people relate to their memories and their past. And that was something that I became really fascinated with. And I think that was a result of traveling, I think, definitely, because we don't have those kinds of conditions in Australia. But when I traveled to, say, Cardiff, Beirut, and Chile, I really felt, you know, how present architecture was in people's lives and how important it was to forming their identity.
And it's interesting. It sounds like you have quite an intent when you're making your documentary. Is that how it feels at the time, or is it sometimes that you have to get the camera out and start filming before you start to understand exactly what the documentary is going to be?
Before I went to Beirut, well, the first film I made in Beirut, we only had 10 days in Beirut, so I had a sort of plan before I went there, and the plan was really to make a short film in the taxis, you know, something to do with the Civil War, but the path and the characters and all of that was very much established when I got there, because you have to be there to really understand the geography of the city.
And what an exciting process to see those characters sort of develop and the film developing as you go, you know?
I mean, at the time, I didn't have much technical skills. My mum had bought me a handycam, like a Sony handycam, and I just took the handycam and a little MP3 recorder into the taxis, and I would just start rolling as soon as we got in. And with the interpreter, we would ask if it's okay if we continue filming or not, and if they said no, then we would just go to the next person.
You would just pay the cab fare and move on.
Yeah, we did. It was an expensive exercise, but
yeah, I bet.
Not really. I mean, it was an amazing experience.
I was going to say, isn't that interesting how often the equipment that you have to work with can really, in some ways you could say it limits, but in other ways it defines the work that you produce. Yeah. You know, and having watched that film and seeing the north, south, east, west, the static shots versus the movement in the taxi.
Yeah.
You know, that to me was quite beautiful. And it really made me think of things like the Oscars foreign language film, Ida, the filmmaker who shot that. Mm. You know, I listened to an interview from him and he talked about how they didn't have a lot of options for moving shots, and so the film is full of these beautiful
static
images.
Shots. Yeah, it's a beautiful film. It's so well composed in that way. But I think that constraints are the best thing for creative practice, because they make you think about other things, you know, like in terms of gear. I mean, I think we always get really caught up in what camera you're using, you know, what's your setup and blah blah blah, but the most important thing is the idea. Yeah. If you don't have a good idea, then the you know, quality of the camera is, you know, not really important.
It's so true. And talking about ideas, I guess the next step, you went back to Beirut, well, many times, but you filmed another documentary called Beirut Under the Bridge, which was focusing on the struggle to restore public transport in a post-war metropolis and how the situation impacted or was impacted by the lack of a unified civil society. What compelled you to tell that story? What was the next step that said, all right, I'm going back and I'm telling this story?
I mean, for me, being in Beirut was such a formative experience. I think that being in Beirut was just a place that I loved to spend time in.
Yeah.
And I had made a lot of connections whilst I was there making vehicles of memory. And I actually came across those transport terminals as I was making the taxi film.
Wow.
And I was really like, I have to come back. This is something that needs more exploration. And after Vehicles of Memory got into the Al Jazeera Film Festival, you know, I spoke to a few producers there and, you know, spoke to them about my idea. But because I was 19, I didn't have much behind me for them to go, we'll give you a budget. Yeah. So, actually I was working in an architecture firm in Melbourne, and I was just saving money to go back to Beirut. But, you know, I was still trying to make architecture work for me, but, I decided to resign to go to Beirut.
and I mean, just take away the creative side alone. Being 19, did you travel with anyone over there, obviously, in the first couple of times? Or was it just you at 19 doing your thing?
The first time I was with my class, so there was a professor and six other students. Yes. And the second time I was 20, so it was a year later, and I just went by myself. I had nobody... I had nobody with me, and when I got there, I was just, you know, making the most of the contacts I'd made from the previous trip, but I was, like, you know, living in a hostel and making, you know, making friends, and actually I was working with one girl who was also an architecture student at UTS, and we were really good friends, and luckily she was over there the same time that I was, and she became my assistant on Under the Bridge. And then I met another influential person in my life. His name was Ali, and he was working in public policy over there. And I pitched the film to him at a house party. And then he became my second assistant. So it was literally like just me and Diana, or me and Ali, in these transport terminals with, like, you know, dozens of Syrian men staring at us and military coming up to us, you know. At one point, the Iranian president was visiting Beirut and there was a lot of protests going on, and a few guards came up to us and asked us if we had guns in our bags. And, yeah, and it was a bit... And there was, like, military tanks all around that area, and it was a bit overwhelming, but... Yeah. You know, we just waited. Basically, we filmed for 8 weeks, all observational footage in those terminals. And so we were pretty patient, you know, with what we were getting.
Yeah. Wow. Oh. So in 2011, you were invited to collaborate with a group of architects, designers and social NGOs from Chicago and San Diego who were working on an earthquake reconstruction project in Talca. And from this, your first long-form documentary, Talca Interrupted, was born. Now, on the documentary website, you say, whilst this is a Chilean story, it deeply addresses the physical and psychological traumas of natural disasters plaguing many parts of the world today, including Australia, Japan, New Zealand, and Southeast Asia. So obviously, you are quite driven to tell these stories in Beirut. How important is it for you to continue to be telling universal global stories through your work?
Well, I think for filmmakers today, there isn't really any limitations with regards to context, you know, because, you know, technology is so readily available and it's, you know, relatively cheap to travel. I mean, for me, I think that there's stories everywhere, and it's just important for me to find the right story that does have that universal themes that can connect with a lot of people. I mean, at that time when I was in Chile, there was also the Japan earthquake and tsunami. The Haiti earthquake happened about 2 months before the Chilean earthquake. So there was a lot of turmoil around the world with natural disasters. And I think that, you know, there was a lot of stories being told at the time. There was really a lot of focus about filmmakers working in disaster zones, and I actually contributed to a publication called Film on the Fault Line recently, which is being published this year, which is about filmmakers working in disaster zones and how they react to those situations. But ultimately, you know, I just wanted to give a voice to that community, because when I got there, there wasn't much media attention in Chile because of the Haiti earthquake was so much bigger than the Chilean earthquake. So all of the media focus was in Haiti, yeah. And hardly anything was on Chile. So I was very driven to give them a voice and tell their stories to the best of my ability.
And that's one of those things, isn't it? You must see certain themes come up again and again. And, you know, we look at Beirut under the bridge, and this idea of one of the gentlemen, one of the local workers, mentions that he feels like this idea that change is actually pulling them backwards rather than going forwards. And the same in Telka Interrupted, where it's this idea of they feel like they're almost living in the past or trapped in the past rather than looking to the future. So this idea of movement through life, is that something that you find comes up again and again with your work, or is that just something that comes naturally and just happens, depends what the film is?
It's definitely a focus in my work, how people deal with their past. And I think that, you know, I mean, that's probably a result of my own personal experience. I mean, my main focus in the Chilean film is what is the meaning of home, and you know, for me, having, you know, moved, having no stability in my life in my childhood, the meaning of home was really an unanswered question. And when I was in that town with that family, and the importance of their family home and all of the memories and nostalgia associated with that place, it really fascinated me because it was so different to my experience. And it was really beautiful the way that people associate themselves to a particular building. You know, it's just like unbelievable, like the emotion that the destroyed house created for that family, you know, how inherent it was to their identity and their childhood. So, I mean, that was my main focus. It was that particular family house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, because after that, you kind of seem to more clearly make the move from documentary to narrative films.
Mm-hmm.
But again, through your narrative films, you know, 17 Years and a Day, and mm-hmm. again in High Tide, which you did made recently in Barcelona, mm-hmm. Themes of family and presence of and influence of a father in your life, and also the Phoenix and... thinking of all the titles here, The Guard, you know, dealing with refugees and what their family life was like. So it's really interesting to hear you say that.
Mm.
Do you feel that your work is in large part, you know, a lot of writers and a lot of artists talk about how much of themselves they bring into their work. Do you feel like you're in part always telling a bit of your own story, or how black and white is it?
I think that, for me, when I tell a story, I have to have some personal relationship to that story. Like, I have to have experienced it or witnessed it. And that makes the story more real and more authentic for me to take it on. Otherwise, I feel it's inauthentic and not my story to tell, because there's so many stories that you can tell. There's so many approaches. But I think what makes someone's work authentic and real is what they bring to the project.
Would you say you feel a strong connection to your Iranian heritage in your work?
I think more recently I've been exploring my heritage and my personal background in my work. You know, for the first few years I was making films overseas about, you know, circumstances that weren't specifically relating to my heritage or my story. But when I came back from those experiences, I decided to look inside myself a bit more and, you know, explore my own identity. Yeah, I mean, my Iranian heritage is so important to me. I grew up in a very Iranian household. My mum only spoke Farsi in the house, and I had a lot of Iranian friends, and we celebrate all the traditions and New Year's and my mom's a big influence in that sense. And Iranian storytellers and filmmakers are a huge influence in my work.
Yeah.
So
mainstream films like the 2012 Oscar-nominated film Argo present a rather violent depiction of Iran, which is some people's only exposure to the country. In our research for this interview, one thing we uncovered was an article by Brandon Stanton, and he's the photographer who runs the Humans of New York blog.
Yeah.
About a trip that he made to Iran to take photos and get stories for his site.
Yeah.
And on the site he says, "The people that live in Iran are the exact same people that live in New York City. They're just wearing different clothes, speaking a different language, and praying in a different way. How do you feel about the view of Iran that Western media generally presents to the world?"
Well, I think that, you know, films like Argo, they don't help the current situation. I mean, they're just reinforcing a story that works for the US audience. And it wasn't a genuine representation of the people there. But, yeah, I mean, sometimes it is frustrating when you meet people and that they're not very clear about your background, or it's because of all of the propaganda that surrounds the Middle East, and I'm always encouraging my friends and colleagues to travel to Iran and see it for themselves, because it's not what you see in the media. It's absolutely the opposite. You know, people are so hospitable. There's so many beautiful sites to see. There's over 70 World Heritage sites. I mean, it was ancient Persia. You know, it's not just a desert, and we're not just developing atomic weapons.
Yeah, yeah.
there's a lot of history and tradition, you know, 3,000 years of history. So,
but I guess as well, that's why one of the beauties of new technology, isn't it, is this idea that whilst there is propaganda out there, there's young filmmakers and just people with a camera that can actually put stuff online and show the other side of the story.
No, I think that's a really positive aspect, and that social media is playing a big role as well. There's a lot of campaigns coming through that are expressing, you know, the human face of the Iranian people, not just, you know, what you read in the media. So I think social media is making a huge impact.
Okay, now if we're looking at the projects that you've done so far, and I guess we look back on all that work that we've presented back to you and spoken about already on the podcast, it seems that in a lot of those films you've both written and directed.
Yeah.
It seems to be important to you to be involved with both sides. Is it important, or is that important to making sure that the original idea that you have comes to fruition? Do you feel comfortable writing something and then letting it out into the world, or is that a part of your style to really, I guess, control throughout the entire stage?
I mean, I think I'm at an early stage in my career, and you know, so far I've been writing and directing, and I'm very passionate to continue that trajectory. But I'm very open to co-writing and collaborating on projects that I believe in that may not be written by me. As long as I feel a connection to the project, I'm keen to pursue it.
Yeah, and it is so exciting that you say that you're at such an early stage in your career, and it just makes me think, gee, Where was I when I was 20?
I'm 25
what,
now.
No, I know, but what foreign country was I, you know, filmmaking and
where
making
were you last
my,
year? Yeah.
Oh, yes, that's what I meant. But you have, of course, won, you know, quite a few awards. You've screened at all sorts of international film festivals. Beirut Under the Bridge won numerous international awards at festivals and television broadcasts, including Best Director and the Special Jury Prize at the Beirut Film Festival. You've also had film screen at the Cannes Film Corner, and as you said earlier, the Al Jazeera International Documentary Film Festival. How has your experience been touring your films around the festival circuit?
I mean, I think it's so important to travel to a festival when your film is playing there, because I think that it's great to see audiences' reactions to your films and you know, having a dialogue about that film. Creating awareness about the issues around the films, that's really important to me. And meeting other filmmakers at film festivals, it's a beautiful experience, because you really come to understand what, you know, what's important to other people, how are they telling their stories, how can we connect, how can we collaborate. And it becomes a very, you know, very enriching dialogue when you see them at those festivals and connect with them on that level. But I just wanted to mention, when I was at Beirut Film Festival for Under the Bridge, basically the issue of public transport hadn't really been addressed until that point, and we had, you know, full house for all of the sessions. And, you know, what made me really excited is the public dialogue that it created, to the point where I was on like morning TV. Wow. Being interviewed about, you know, public transport in Lebanon. And
wow.
And, you know, after the film was released, you know, there was a lot of PhD students and researchers contacting me for the film and asking me for more information. So I wrote an essay for a design journal that, you know, is quite extensive, and it covers like all aspects of that topic.
It brings up such an interesting point too, because I guess you work so hard on a project, especially in this that format, that you're spending so much time engrossed in it that you become a little bit of a mini expert, don't you, on the topic?
Yeah, I was a mini expert. But the thing is that when you're an outsider going into a country with so much history and conflict, I think at the same token, you know, I didn't get positive feedback from everybody, because, you know, when a filmmaker from outside comes and tells you a story, a problem that's happening in your own city, I think some people get a little bit taken aback. Yeah. Like,
yep.
You know, I mean, even on that morning show, the presenter asked me, she's like, "Who are you to tell our story?"
Wow.
And wow. I was just like on live TV with Ali, my producer, and we were just like, well, you know, someone should tell it.
Yeah, and isn't that interesting? So you have created, all of your films touch on really important topics in one way or another. And once they've screened at film festivals, what's the journey for the next? Are you interested in VOD or iTunes? I don't know. I don't even know how it works. Like, what's the next process in distribution, or how can people continue to benefit from them?
I mean, thankfully that particular film was picked up by Canopy Distribution, which deals with educational purchases, you know, for libraries and for universities. So that's an avenue where people can see it. VOD, it's also available on Distrify, which is like a VOD network. It's very important for me to continue having audiences for my films. I mean, you know, after the festival release, it can just disappear. And I think it's really important to continue the dialogue, you know, continue getting it out there. And I've just started some personal distribution as well of those films, of those first documentaries, just because, you know, I just want to keep them out, keep them alive, keep getting them out there. And I think that it's really important for filmmakers to push their work into the world.
And I like, just following on this idea of distribution, I guess you're a filmmaker that's right on that crest of the wave where, you know, VOD and new forms of distributing media is really starting to take off, like even subscription services like Netflix or whatever it might be. How do you think that will affect filmmaking into the future? Do you reckon it will change the art form because of the simple fact of the matter is of the way that subscription services work? Or do you think that the art form will stay true and it will just work around the way that it's delivered?
Because there's more options in how films are viewed and purchased, it's a good thing for filmmakers.
Yeah.
As long as they know their rights, they know how to, you know, sign over copyright and, you know, at least, you know, keep some. Because the thing is that you can sign the copyright of your project to a producer and then you'll never see a penny of that again. Do you know what I mean? So I think filmmakers just have to be really careful about what they're signing and who they're collaborating with when it comes to these platforms, because you can really get lost in the world of distribution.
And what about the way that it's presented too? Obviously, with more people watching movies, even on their phones, on their laptops, I guess it changes the viewer's experience too. So will that come more into filmmakers' thinking as well, in your thoughts?
I think that's really sad. I'm never going to make a film for the purpose of someone to watch it on their iPhone. I mean, I think that's a really sad aspect of it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we make films for the purpose, I mean, I make films for the purpose of them being seen, at, you know, in a cinema, yeah. at least a small one.
Yeah.
Or, you know, because...
At least on a projector
screen.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I don't want someone to be watching my film while they're checking their Facebook notifications and sending a text to their boyfriend or...
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, I think that the...
You want 100% concentration on the film.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to watch a film, at least, you know, give it the respect and time that it yeah. deserves. And when you're in a cinema, you can't escape, you know, you're just there and you're facing that direction and that's all you're focused on. So I think being in a cinema is the best way to watch a film.
Yeah, yeah. And it's an experience, of course, too. You're yeah. getting a complete experience rather than just...
Complete experience. But, yeah. I mean, obviously, not all films can be viewed in a cinema setting, but, you know, as long as there's, you know, an appropriate setting for the viewing of a film, that would be ideal.
And so, of course, I met you last year, Nora,
yeah.
when I had the great privilege to work as acting coach
mm-hmm.
on your VCA Masters film, which was The Phoenix, or yes. is The Phoenix.
Yes, it is The Phoenix.
The present tense. And, of course, you know, you talk about films that should be screened in cinemas, and, I mean, that's a really artistically beautiful, stylized film, and that's, I mean... That was my first
Thanks,
exposure
Lauren.
To you. And oh, you know I loved it.
Yeah,
I can definitely see what you mean about you shoot for a film to be seen in a cinema. And I think,
yeah.
you know, it has so much more emotional impact on you.
I mean, I think that, you know, for example, TV is shot really differently. Like there's a lot of close-ups. There's, you know, they do keep in mind that there's multiple platforms for their programs. Mm-hmm. And... So they shoot in a certain way. But I think, you know, for short films and, you know, the films that I'm interested in making, it's more about creating that full body experience, I guess.
I love it.
Rather than, you know, I remember when I was editing The Phoenix, I you know, sent a rough cut to my friend and he's just unbelievable. He watched on his iPhone. And his feedback was that, you know, there weren't enough close-ups. And I was like, well, maybe because you're watching it on your iPhone, mate, you know. Just like, and then I never gave it to him again. So, yeah.
He learned his lesson.
Yeah.
How do you find when you're making a film, how do you feel about getting feedback?
Yeah, I'm very active in finding the right people to get feedback, especially during the edit process. And... at some points during the script writing process, because I think that you can get very attached to the story, especially when you've written and directed it. It's like, you know, it's your baby and and it's very hard to be objective. So it's really good to have people who you trust to, you know, give you the feedback to sort of make it the best film it can be. But at the end of the day, you have to make the tough decisions. And, you know, that's something that I think all filmmakers struggle with, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's jump forward to this year in the life of Nora Niasari, because you've been up to some pretty exciting things of late. In
yes.
February, you were in Barcelona at the 2015 Abbas Kiarostami
yes.
filmmaking workshop.
Maybe you should repeat that.
Okay.
Because I don't want him to... I want his name to be...
Wow, the guest telling us what to do. I don't know how I feel about this, Nick.
That. Maybe
I'm so sorry. No, it's because, you know...
I know, totally.
I'm just imagining him in my head.
Abbas yeah. Kiarostami.
Yes, great. Okay. Good, very good.
So let's jump forward to what you've been up to recently. What's happening in 2015 for Nora Niasari? Because you were in Barcelona in February and you travelled there to work with Abbas Kiarostami, who is an Iranian filmmaker... is one of the most important figures in contemporary Iranian film. And, of course, you were there under the umbrella of the 2015 Abbas Kiarostami Filmmaking Workshop. You mentioned in your story that your mum took you to the Brisbane Film Festival where you saw his films for the first time. So this seems like some wonderful synchronicity. And what is it about Kiarostami's work that has been so influential for you?
Kiarostami's cinema, it explores... the poetry of everyday life, and it shines a light on those situations that, you know, we often overlook, you know, in our day-to-day lives. So for me, it's so important, his work, because he's very influenced by landscape and by human behavior, and he's a very observational filmmaker in terms of working with, you know, he worked a lot in villages of Iran, and he's very much about exploring issues that are important to him and things that reflect his own life, because all of his films that he's made are based on his own experiences or based on the time that he spent in those places. So I think that line of filmmaking is very similar to what I'd like to pursue.
Can you talk to us about what the workshop was like and the film that you created under his guidance?
So I've been wanting to do a Kiarostami workshop for about 10 years. I mean, it's been my lifelong dream to meet him and work under his guidance. He's my personal hero. And yeah, as I said, I've been watching his films from you know, the age of six. So his work has been really important and formative to my filmmaking process. And yeah, I mean, it was a really life-changing experience to be, you know, in that workshop. I mean, there was 50 other filmmakers from around the world there. We had about 10 days to make a short film. And, you know, we were lucky to have his guidance from, you know, the generation of the idea until the end, until the projection. So basically we pitched the idea to him, and then he would sort of approve it for shoot, and then we shot under his guidance as well, and we edited under his guidance too, and it was all with the theme that he presented on the first day. So it was like very much an impulsive process. Like, you didn't have time to think about it before the first day because you didn't know what the theme was. So he's very intelligent and strategic in that way.
and did when you finally met this man after so many years, was it exactly what you expected it to be? Obviously, you know, when you meet heroes and sometimes you're a little unsure, was it what you'd hoped it would be?
Yeah, it was, but I was a bit starstruck, to be honest. For the first 2 days, I didn't know what to say to him. I was, like, nervous, and I was just, like, you know, kicking myself, you know. But I got over it after a few days, but it was a beautiful experience. I mean, he's such a humble and generous mentor, and he's done many workshops, and he's very passionate about running these workshops and, you know, giving the next generation of filmmakers, you know, this skill set. And he's not necessarily teaching you anything, and that's what he says at the beginning, but it's more about understanding yourself and the way that you see the world, and, you know, telling a story that's true to you. And so that was a beautiful thing to be reminded of, and something that's very important to practice for any filmmaker. And also we had a lot of constraints because, we had a lot of constraints, and that's how the workshop is set up, you know, for you to overcome your fear of making a film, because, you know, we get so bogged down in generation of ideas and production and budget and blah, blah, blah. And you just have, you know, 10 days to make a film, and that's it. You know, you just have to do it. So it's a really good exercise for anybody, really.
So can you talk us through that? So he gave you the theme, which was?
It was the sea.
Okay. And then you spent 2 days being starstruck. And what happened on day three?
No, so I didn't have... the starstruck was more of an internal process. Yes, but once he presented the theme, we had 2 days to pitch an idea to him and all of the other participants. And then once he approved your idea, then you could start shooting in Barcelona. And yeah, I mean, that was quite daunting, you know, as well, like pitching your idea to Abbas Kiarostami. And it wasn't like a one-on-one thing. It was he's sitting in the audience.
Oh, wow.
And you're at the front.
And, of course, I noticed that was it produced by Black Factory?
Yeah, so Black Factory Cinema, it's a group of amazing producers from Colombia who work and live in Barcelona, and they've run a few workshops with him so far, and they're just beautiful, amazing women, you know, making this opportunity for filmmakers around the world.
And did you have to assemble a crew, or was that sort of support provided to the filmmakers?
The idea was that you were an autonomous filmmaker, so you brought your own gear, you brought your own editing equipment, and you were open to collaborate with other filmmakers there. The filmmakers who lived in Barcelona, they had a lot more access to resources. I know a few people actually worked with professional crew in Barcelona because they were, you know, they always work with them. So it was very varied in terms of, so, you know, some people just worked by themselves, some people worked with a professional crew. I worked with, you know, three others who were in the workshop. So yeah, it was a very open exercise. Mm.
And now some other stuff that's going on for you as well, Nora, is that you've just been nominated for Best Director of a Student Film at the Australian Directors Guild Awards for The Phoenix.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, are the only peer-judged awards for directors.
Yeah, and it's very exciting.
It is very exciting. And can we do a bit of a drum roll? Can we put a bit of a, you know, did you win?
No, I didn't. Oh. I didn't win, but it didn't matter. I mean, just being nominated is such a big deal, and it's such an honor to be a part of that ceremony, and to be acknowledged by, you know, directors who are very established in the industry. So yeah, it was an amazing thing to be nominated.
Oh, definitely.
and a beautiful event as well, and just connecting with other filmmakers was great.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so we've talked about so much of your stuff that you've accomplished over the past little while. I mean, you're not going to rest on your laurels. There's obviously some other things in the pipeworks at the moment.
Yeah, well, I'm actually editing the Talca documentary. It's not finished. Yeah,
I did notice yeah. that was in post-production.
Yeah, so I've been working on it since 2011, and I'm hoping to finish it this year.
And can I just ask about that? Because we did notice that you were invited for pitching at the Australian International Documentary Conference for that. Is that for funding, or is that, how was that?
So the pitching at AIDC, I did pitching at AIDC and also a doc meeting in Buenos Aires in Argentina. And
great
both
city.
Of those, yeah, amazing city.
Mm-hmm. Great steak, great red wine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful people.
Well, I haven't been. Thanks, guys.
That's all right. You'll be there soon.
One day,
I'm
Lauren,
sure you will.
One day.
Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So those pitching workshops are really for pitching to broadcasters to see if you can get a pre-sale. And so it's mostly for funding and for making connections with broadcasters and distributors.
And how do you find that? I mean, Nick and I have been working on a couple of short film projects for a while now.
Yeah.
And I'm normally just the actor who would come in on a film project. So it's quite interesting being on the other side and sort of understanding how long it can take. How do you stay patient? Do you have any advice for us? For
meditation.
Me?
I think that you have to take on a project. If you're going to take on a project that doesn't have funding at the beginning and that it's a bit of a long haul, you have to take on a project that's really important to you and that you are passionate enough to, you know, stay in there when times are tough and stay in there when you get rejections, because there's a lot. And I mean, I think the most important thing is that, you know, it's an important project to you. Don't take on anything but something that means something to you, and do it for the right reasons as well. Mm.
Great advice for upcoming filmmakers. Now, Nora, this is literally our last question, and we always have a little bit of fun with the last question.
Okay.
So I've prepared this one, which is quite architectural, really, but it has a little bit of a storytelling bias. So take a moment to have a think about this one. All right?
Okay.
Is there a building in the world that you most identify with? What story does that structure tell that makes you feel so closely connected with it?
So when I was in Lebanon, I traveled to Tripoli and we went on a tour to this place called, so we went to Tripoli and we went to a site that was designed by Oscar Niemeyer, who's a Brazilian modernist architect. And this site it was supposed to be a trade market or a trade show. So there was like multiple structures and buildings in this huge site, and basically the project was built up until the start of the Civil War, and then they ceased construction and funding. So basically that site there is an abandoned masterpiece. And, you know, being there, I've been there twice, and in each time that I went there, I just felt an incredible connection to that place. And yeah, because it had such a beautiful, it had so much beautiful potential, and yet it still has, you know, an incredible presence in the city. And just spatially, there's so much variety. There's so much, there's so many places to explore. The light and sound that he created through those buildings is just phenomenal. I've never had that kind of experience before, walking into a building and just feeling overwhelmed. So yeah, I think that was my most incredible architecture experience, and a place that I really connect with, because it's kind of how do you say, I don't know, I have a bit of a ruin fetish as well.
Yep, likes
you know
ruin.
What I mean, I love, you know, I love, it's just because it's simultaneously beautiful and
packed with history. It's beautiful.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah,
from a time that was so different to ours usually, you know. It's I agree.
Are you a ruin fetishist too, Dick?
I've seen a lot of ruins in my time, so I think I do have a ruin fetish as well.
Yeah, it's called the World Trade Fair, but I don't think that people can travel to Tripoli at the moment because of the terrible conflict that's happening in Syria, and so it's just on the border there. But yeah, that was an incredible experience. It's simultaneously beautiful and tragic because it's like this unfulfilled potential. I think it's really important to not to forget the architects of that time, because they did such incredible work around the world, and I think we should, you know, always make the effort to see it.
We'll always make the effort to see your films, Nora, in the future. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thanks so much, guys. It was a great experience and great questions.
Oh, phew.
Yeah.
Really. They were great answers.
Well, that was brilliant. That was such an awesome interview. And there's so many things that I really appreciate about Nora's perspective on creating art, particularly one of them, you know, when she was talking about the workshop with Abbas Kiarostami, and we were asking about, you know, what it was like finally working with him and meeting him, and she said how she was starstruck, and we asked what she learnt, and she said it wasn't necessarily that he taught them anything, but that he helped them to understand themselves and the way that they see the world, so that telling stories is true to where they come from. Isn't that what we're trying to discover through this podcast? Each month when we talk to people, what their voice is, how they see the world, and what storytelling means to them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I keep going back to this, but it's that your own voice. What is it? And you got to get that right before you start thinking about how you can affect the world and share stories. You've got to know what your own voice is, because I think that sense of authenticity as well really rings true, and people can see that in the work.
Absolutely. And it makes me think about how many years it's taken me to get to a point where I do feel like I understand what my voice is. And obviously that perception is always changing and refining.
Yeah.
What about you, Nick? What was your takeout from that interview?
My takeout was, I wrote it down as soon as she said it, and I really loved it. It was, constraints are the best thing for creative practice. I really love that. It's this idea of turning a negative, what most people think is a negative, in constraints. You know, she used the idea of what camera she was using. But then turning that into a positive, so that can be almost a treatment for your film, you know? So it's this idea that sometimes constraints set a direction for you, and then it can actually open up all these pathways along that road so that you can really, really get to a beautiful purpose and an intent for your film or your story, whatever it may be. So I really love that.
That is so true. And isn't that interesting? It's just like finding your voice. You need those constraints to give you an angle or a perspective or a way into the story. Here we are at the end of podcast 15. You're about to buy me a crystal present.
Yes, I will. Expect that in the mail any day now. Yeah. Have you got any recommendations for this month, Lauren?
I certainly do have a recommendation. I was lucky enough to go to, everyone knows I'm a bit of a fan of Friday on My Mind.
Yes, you are after, a fan, yes,
that AFTERS runs at Acme on Friday evenings. I mean, that's a recommendation in itself for anyone who's in Melbourne who hasn't got along to this yet. And I don't know if AFTERS runs a similar thing in Sydney, to be honest.
I might have to look that up. You know, you're such a big advocate of it. I'll have to go and check it out up here.
And of course, this Friday was Ariel Kleiman, who is a Melbourne filmmaker and a VCA grad. And he is pretty amazing. He reminded me a lot of Nora in terms of general filmmaking brilliance and his approach to his work.
Mm.
He made an amazing 20-minute short. It's called Deeper Than Yesterday, which screened at Sundance 2011 and also won the Grand Jury Prize. And it's interesting that you talked about how place can affect you, both at the top of this podcast and you've also talked about it in previous months. And this beautiful and moving short film is set in a submarine. And it examines that very issue, how place can affect you, particularly over time, and how it can change a person.
Yes.
I'm going to put a link up on our website and on Facebook because you can currently view it on Vimeo.
Fantastic.
But the film that was the reason for the interview for Friday on My Mind, and which is my main recommendation, is his first feature, Partisan, which started screening at cinemas just over a week ago.
Okay. Do you know what cinemas? Is it Select Cinemas?
Got the website open here and it's all over the place. In a great way. Dendy Palace and the Ritz in New South Wales, in Victoria, Nova, Elsternwick Classic, Kino and Palace. And it's on at Luna in WA.
A lot of those boutique cinemas, great.
And I'm not sure how many weeks it's on for, but I would completely recommend it. It's sort of set in a nowhere land. It's not a political film and he didn't want to specifically tie it to any real world place, but it does look at a child, Alexander, who's playful and curious like any kid would be, but he's also a trained assassin. Whoa. And growing up seeing the world through the eyes of his father, and is based on his co-writer Sarah found an article about this child assassin in Colombia. So that is my recommendation.
Great.
And, I'll put a link on the website. What about you, Nick?
I've got a recommendation for you. I went to the World Press Photo 2015 exhibition the other night at the State Library of New South Wales in the city of Sydney. It is running till the 21st of June. It's basically an independent, non-for-profit organisation committed to supporting and advancing photojournalism and documentary as well across the world. And I like this little quote from them that is, "We exist to inspire understanding of the world through quality photojournalism." It was quite an amazing experience. I always love going to check out beautiful exhibitions. And this was really a snapshot, I guess, of 2015. So there was basically over 97,000 images submitted for this exhibition from over 5,000 photojournalists. And it was cut down to a very select number of photos. Yeah. And what I loved about it was these photos were brilliant, but they also had a story behind each photo that they quite beautifully connected to the photo. So, you know, it had very confronting images in regards to just a couple of selections without ruining it was a photo of MH17, the crash, that had a body in the airplane seat in the middle of a field. It had another image of the moment after clemency had been given to someone who was about to be hanged, and it had other long timeline photos as well. So it had one particular set of photos that followed a family over the period of about 10 years from when the family was very happy right through the death of the mother via AIDS and then the incarceration of the husband via child abuse. And I mean, incredibly powerful images and stories. And I urge anyone who's got the opportunity, Storytelling through photos is so amazing, isn't it? Because sometimes it's the photo that strikes you just simply by looking at it, and sometimes it's the story behind the photo that really makes the photo what it is. And I could have spent, to be honest, I probably didn't give myself enough time. I could spend another couple of hours there.
And but even for anyone who isn't in Sydney, like even the website really goes into the photographers and.
But a really beautiful snapshot into the past year. So I urge anyone in Sydney to go and have a look.
And what else have you got coming up, Nick?
Lauren,
more meditation?
More meditation, definitely. I think what I want to plan for my month ahead is I feel like last month really got out of my control. And so when I was thinking about what my next month might entail, I just wanted to give it a couple of really strong intentions to make sure that I can hit this month. And I'll revisit them in the next podcast and see how I went. So here's my list. First of all, Lauren, I intend to see a significant step in our short film that we're creating. And I know we haven't really talked about it much in this podcast, but I really hope to see a significant step this month from that short. I intend to start writing some comedy sketches this month, Lauren. Enough said about that for now. I intend to be inspired by my work at Rob Marchand's workshop, which is happening this month.
Oh, is that this month?
It's this month. Really looking forward to that. And I haven't talked to you about this yet, but I think this is worth putting out into the world. I intend to see a blog related to this podcast.
Yes, absolutely. We have talked about that a little bit.
We have, but we haven't put it out to the world to say, can we have it in some kind of shape for next month to say exactly what we're doing with that? So that's all I want from this month. I just want some strong intentions, and hopefully I can tick a couple of those intents off as I go throughout the month, and I'll report back in when we speak next. What about your intentions for this month, Lauren? Have you got a couple?
It's actually really interesting. I was thinking earlier, I think July is going to be a very busy month, and I'm conscious of the fact that we're still in June and I don't want to get lost in what's happening in July. Yeah. So I really want to use the next few weeks just to consolidate.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to talk about, God, I don't want to come back from Bali and sound like a bit of a hippie, but I actually have had some weird dreams recently. I had a dream about a week before I left. I looked up and I saw a cluster of about 5 or 6 huntsmen lowering on a rope towards my bed.
What?
And I actually woke up. I was standing near my bedroom door saying, what the fuck? and I just kicked the heater. So I had a bruise on my leg. And that was the moment I woke up. So it was quite a clear image for me. And I was telling Ali and a few other people in Bali, I said, I had this crazy dream recently. Check out this bruise on my leg. And Ali said that in Native American beliefs, spiders are very powerful images about writing and also creation. And on the night after I spoke to you in Ubud, I had a dream where all these little spiders were caught in the mosquito net above my bed.
Oh, wow. Are there multiple spiders coming into your life to tell you to do some writing, Lauren Bailey? What is it?
Well, I think there's definitely something in there about writing, and I already have sort of acted on that. But it's also about creating. And if you do some research into it, there's a few things it can mean. And one of them is looking at how you're currently trying to deal with things in your life.
Okay.
And that you may have come to an impasse on creatively and finding new ways around them. And don't know how much other people believe in signs and things, but I'm going to tap right into that because I can't see any harm in it creatively.
Well, that's what I say too. It's like it's not necessarily whether you believe it or not. If it helps you with where you're going in your life and it puts you in a mental state that will help you, it can't be bad, right? Like even if the spiders mean nothing, but you take it as an intent to write more, that's
even if I go beyond that and just look at, okay, well, I'm in this position of really wanting to trust myself and listen to myself.
Yeah.
What do I want to do? Posing that question to myself and saying, yeah, that is something I really want to engage in. I think as much as I can set some intents for the month ahead, I think it'll also be really good to touch back in next month and just see where those ideas have led me and what's come out of that.
Great. Yay. Well, we've got some real, I guess, intent for the start of next month, and we'll have to report back and give you the goss on how far we went in the month ahead.
Yeah. And also we had Jamie Hansen posted some great stuff about the conversation last month about what do you do.
Mm.
that I want to talk about next month because I've sort of been out of the industry here. So we will definitely tap back into that.
I had a bit of a look at the link Jamie posted too in regards to the minimalists, which was quite good. So maybe we can have a chat about that.
Definitely, we will. And so in the meantime, of course, please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, SoundCloud, website,
iTunes. There's about plenty of opportunities.
You'll find us.
And remember, we still have a survey, so please go to our Facebook. You'll find the link to the survey in the Facebook page feed. Please go and check that out and give us your feedback. We love to hear what you think of the podcast and where we can improve. So continue to join us on the Act of Storytelling.
And thanks for listening.